You're listening to the Integrated Music Teaching Podcast from Top Music. Tune in weekly as we interview music teachers and experts from around the world to explore creative activities and ideas that build learning connections in students. Our integrated music teaching approach will deepen your students' understanding of musical concepts, engage them in critical thinking, improve their reading and performance, foster their curiosity, and prepare them for a lifetime of music making.
Tara Wright here, and welcome back to the Integrated Music Teaching Podcast from Top Music Co. At Top Music, we love guiding and supporting music teachers just like you to engage, motivate, and inspire your students and run the most sustainable studio business possible using our integrated music teaching system. It's great to be with you for another week of the Integrated Music Teaching Podcast. Our episode today is actually from the archive episodes from way back in 2018 with none other than the Piano Guy himself, John Schmidt from the Piano Guys. In this interview, John gives us the inside scoop of his awesome YouTube videos, as well as his thoughts on tampering with the classics and what we can do to inspire the next generation of creative pianists.
Well, today's the day you get to meet my first ever celebrity guest, and he needs little introduction. My guest is an American pianist, composer, piano teacher, and author. Classically trained, he branched into New Age music in his 20s and has developed a classical crossover style that blends classical, contemporary, and rock and roll. Since 2010, he has been a member of the Piano Guys group, performing on their YouTube videos, albums, and in concert, and often next to waterfalls or on top of cliffs. In August 2016, they surpassed 1 billion views on their YouTube channel and now have well over 6 million subscribers. Welcome to the show, John Schmidt.
Thank you very much, Tim.
First up, I've got to ask you about the backgrounds on your YouTube videos where you're, you know, playing a grand piano on the top of a cliff and then the next minute you're next to a waterfall and then you're in the Arctic Circle or somewhere. How do you do all this? Is this all just computer magic or are you actually there?
We're actually there. We're crazy. And Paul Anderson, one of the piano guys, owned a piano store, had a bunch of pianos and wanted to plug his store and do promo. And he'd always thought it would be cool to make videos with pianos in the most random places imaginable. And, so we've got 4 of the 7 wonders of the world. And one time we lifted a piano literally with a helicopter on top of a 1,000-foot cliff. And we have never green screened one of them.
So, wow.
We used a green screen for Cello Wars because we needed a Death Star, and that was just hard to come by, the real Death Star.
That's fair enough. So you're actually helicoptering these pianos into these places. I mean, that must either cost a fortune or be incredibly difficult.
Actually, Paul has a friend that has helicopter connections. So Paul's got a lot of good friends, but we've only used a helicopter once. We've used a crane. But a lot of times we just, like when we were in the desert, we put down wooden planks and we would leapfrog the planks. Like we'd roll onto one and then move the one behind in front, and we leapfrogged for about 2 hours. And it was just like, 6 of us.
Oh my goodness. Working up quite a sweat, I bet.
Yeah, especially in the early days, we were just kind of doing it for fun and on a bare bones budget. And we still try to keep a bare bones budget because we all have families and we'd rather have the money go to our kids.
So. Mm. And you must have have the piano tuned as well once it's in these positions, I assume.
Well, the thing that's interesting about making piano videos is if you were to use live sound, it would be horrible. It would be wind noise. It would be cars passing, airplanes flying over. So the way it works is you play to a track and you're actually playing, you're actually performing, and there's a real, a real definite click so that you can be right together with the recorded version. And then when you're done, they just drop in that recorded version.
Oh,
right. That's how That's how everybody makes music videos.
Right. And someone was going to had asked me to ask you about that, one of our listeners, how you get the audio and video and everything looking and sounding so good. So that's the actual trick behind it.
Yeah. And you have to practice very, very, I don't know, you have to put a lot of time into the practice to get it all to match up. And you have to literally get all the keystrokes identical to how you recorded it, which is a lot of work.
I was going to say, that would be hard.
I think it's really important for me when I'm playing to have the keystrokes, you know, be what pianists would notice if you're not playing it the same. Yeah. So I try to play it stroke for stroke, exactly the same as the recording.
Mm. Well, so, moving on, how does it feel to be an inspiration to students and teachers all around the world now?
It's unbelievable. I can't really, you know, it hasn't really sunk in, to tell you the truth, but every once in a while we get a sense of it. You know, the comments that are left on the videos, and we have 1.5 billion views now, and those views often have comments that people leave, and many of those have been from pianists and from teachers and from parents, you know, saying thanks for helping my kid not quit.
Right.
You know, it's lit him on fire. Or they come to a concert and we get an email or a comment that says, man, they, you know, they've been practicing ever since we went to your show. And it's really cool. I mean, cause my inspiration was Billy Joel as a teenager. Along with all of the masters, you know, that I was working with that are all dead, unfortunately. But Billy Joel was one that was still alive, and I could watch him. And literally, I owe a lot to his inspiration. Grateful that perhaps I could play that role for somebody else.
I think for me, Billy Joel, Elton John, of course, was another one for me too. But I've still got the songbooks I was given as children. As a child, I should say. And they have a huge impact. I must pass on that I saw one of my adult students yesterday who's come back to piano more recently, and she said that it was actually one of your videos. It was one of your mashups. You did a One Direction song, she said, and that's what got her back into it. So there you go, real personal connection.
Really cool.
Now, I gather you had quite a musical family growing up, and your sister actually taught you piano. Is that right?
Yeah. My parents are German immigrants and grew up on classical music. And my sister, who is 11 years older than me, she studied classical on the college level. She was accepted into a master's performance program as a freshman. So she had major chops.
Right.
And so I got a really nice classical private instruction from her. And she had studied with some really wonderful teachers growing up. She's the best pianist in the family. And I've got big respect for classical artists. Just huge respect. I really feel like it's the classical players that have the highest skill level. And so a lot of respect.
Yeah. Well, I had a classical upbringing as well. And I have to say that if I want to practice and get my chops up, the first thing I'll go to is some Chopin or, you know,
Absolutely. Something
hard. I mean, that's...
They're shredders. They're superhuman. You know, you watch Yu Jia Wang play Flight of the Bumblebee faster in octaves than most people can play with one hand. And it's just like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, you just bow. So it's really, really cool.
So your original piano lessons they're all quite traditional. Did your sister work with you on any contemporary, any chord, pop, anything like that? Or was it really quite classical?
Yeah, it was very classical. And I picked up all of the other stuff on my own. As a teacher, I started teaching when I was about 16 and taught for about 25 years. And I incorporated quite a bit of the stuff that I learned chord wise with students, especially. I think that, you know, classical is the highest skill level. So I think the ideal is to try to get to the classical route if you want to get as good as possible at the piano. But there are so many students I found that didn't enjoy classical music enough that I had to depart from that route. And then the question came to my mind, is it better to try to push them to the ideal in classical and risk them quitting? Or would it be more ideal to try to be creative and to branch off into chord methods and, you know, whatever? I felt sort of like I was a doctor trying to diagnose what the best remedy would be. And I found in many cases that saved my students, that mentality. And but at first I was really classical because that's what I knew. That's what I grew up on, you know, the scale exercises and the classical composers. And it was a really good thing for me to branch out with students. And I felt like this is way better than having them quit.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure there's teachers all around listening to this, nodding their heads going, yes, I feel like a doctor diagnosing every student that comes in. And just when you feel that they're working really well, they'll suddenly start falling off the practice, and then you're analyzing them again and you're diagnosing. So I think that's actually a great analogy.
And some students loved the classical. That's what they really just dialed into. Mm. And I would have to say that I was one of those. I really loved the classical. So I was one that loved two things. So
yeah,
it was interesting. I don't think I would have quit if I just did classical, but it was really nice for me to discover those other aspects, those, like you say, the creative aspects.
Right. So I'm going to come back to a little bit of how you teach in a moment. But when you were younger, I think you were performing as a soloist. This is well before the piano guys. And were you doing, was that classical performance or was that a mix?
It was just my compositions. I started composing music as when I was 11. I wasn't very good at first, but I think I came up with some really good stuff in my teen years. And I've got a song called Waterfall, for example, that I wrote when I was 17. And I'm really happy to see that that song has kind of, infiltrated into a lot of piano teaching. A lot of students are you know, having that piece that they're learning.
Yeah, that's a huge, a lot of fans of that piece. I actually had someone ask.
It's just exciting.
Yeah, I had someone ask, what was the inspiration for that one?
You know, it's interesting. I was studying my classical. A lot of times ideas would come after I the second hour into working on my Bach or my Mozart or whatever. And I was working on a Bach jig. Yeah, let's see.
Oh yeah.
You know, this one that's just so cool. And I loved it so much. I love the feel of it. I did play it without that E flat, just so you know. But anyway. But I just love the feel of it. And after I had worked on it for like an hour or two one day, it just gave birth to, you know, I wanted to make up something with that same meter and that same feel. And it was just cool. It just came, it just hit. And then as I was working on the B theme and so forth, that took a little longer. Altogether, it took about 6 months for me to write Waterfall.
Wow. Oh. And after only 5 or so years of composing too at this stage, and it's now one of your top, you know, the ones that everyone knows.
I know. Yeah. It's just really fun.
Yeah.
And All of Me was another big tune that came like two or three years later. So I had some tunes that I had written, and I started performing them when I was in my early 20s. It was like, I think I was 22 when I did my first concert. And it was just like 200 people there to raise some money for the high school that I went to for their choir trip.
Yeah. So. Well, and by hearing Waterfall too, I immediately thought of All of Me. And I was lucky enough to be putting together the Australian Music Exam Board's last series of books over here. And I included yours at our grade 8 level, All of Me, which is
nice.
a great piece. But of course, as I've been touring around and showing teachers the new pieces, I've been having to actually keep that one current, and it takes a bit of practice, I tell you what.
Okay. That's great. Thank
it's
you.
Good. It's good. So let's go on to your teaching. You said you were a teacher for around 25 years. What styles, I mean, I've gathered you've said, you know, you taught a bit of classical and a bit of modern. Did you have a preference as a teacher now, not just as a student, as a teacher, of which style you were teaching?
You know, my preference was what I had been taught growing up, which was classical. That's what I leaned toward. So I kind of had to figure out other methods by myself. And I would prefer, you know, other methods to having people quit for sure. But one thing I really struggled with was with beginners and teaching note reading. Just struggled. I was losing so many beginners, teaching them the method that I had been taught, which was every good boy does fine and F-A-C-E. And I just, when I was 6 years old, and I actually had a different teacher for about a year or so while my sister was at college. So it was just, it wasn't sinking in. And I went into denial and I started reading the finger numbers. After a year, the key changed out of the key of C to the key of G. And all of a sudden my teacher was mad at me and I had no clue what was going on. So, but that was my experience learning notes. And so as I tried to teach people that same method, I was like, it really didn't work for me. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking, why am I trying it with anyone else? And then I was losing students with that method. And so I thought, you know what? I'm now married and have a child and I've got to pay the bills and I can't have all of these beginners quitting on me because note reading is so hard. So I discovered, I asked myself the question. I said, I wonder if I could just channel all that beginning enthusiasm right to note reading, just like you would in a type class where you just input 20 minutes a day for 2 months. I wonder what would happen. And I tried some experimenting and I found that if I did that after about 2 months, it became something that became kind of automatic because we'd done it 20 minutes a day.
Right.
And then I built a whole method on it. I built a whole note reading method on that and it works awesome. I've got really great feedback from it.
So this is your 67 fun songs. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
All of the method, like what to do each lesson is in the first part of that book.
Right.
Or I think it's moved to the last part of the book in the last printing. But, you know, week by week for 8-10 weeks or something like that, it tells teachers what to do. Or if somebody's trying to do it, you know, do it yourself, it tells you what to do. And it's just like the shortest route
right
from seeing a dot and pushing the right key and not using any scary terminology that would be intimidating at all.
Right.
So
I'm assuming this is, so I would call the every good boy does fine a mnemonic approach,
yeah.
Whereas I'm assuming yours is more a landmark note approach. So students
yes,
just instantly
absolutely.
Recognize bang, 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 and then they
absolutely.
Read intervallically. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because it cuts down the cognitive steps from
100%.
Like 4 to 2.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They're not having to think, what's the rhyme? What is the letter they're getting to? What is that? Yeah, I mean, it's so complex, isn't it? It's amazing that any of us learned that way, I think.
I wonder, just geniuses, I think. I wasn't one.
Now, look, as you've mentioned, I'm a passionate believer in the power of exposing students to chords and progressions from a really early age, and particularly using pop as a context because I find that students can really relate to that. And if they can make those connections between music that they're learning, which could be classical or contemporary, and the music they're listening to, they're more likely to get it. Things like the 12-bar blues and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. When I had a students that were struggling, I would totally ask them, what is your favorite song? I would show them the chords and, you know, we would play, you know, because they had heard it. And that's actually taught me so much is to pick songs that I really loved and try to learn them by ear. Because what it taught me to do is it taught me to analyze it in a way that is much deeper than when you're just reading dots on a page. I gained an understanding and that taught me everything I needed to know about composing. And I would really encourage teachers to, you know, give that challenge to their kids. If there's a tune that they really enjoy, to learn at least 30 seconds of it by ear. And if that's too hard, then just try to pick out the bass part by ear, the lowest notes they hear. And then if that's too hard, I would have my students pick out, or after they got the lowest ones, then I would have my students pick out the highest notes they heard or the melody. you know, once they have the lowest and the highest for a 30-second little spot, and I would say, now, you know, go back and try these six chords. There's six chords that probably fit, you know, in between the hello and the high, you know, and I teach them the one and the two and the three and the four and the five and the six. And it was so sensible for them.
I can't believe how alike our teaching is. I present at workshops for teachers and things, and one of my topics is I call four chord composing, which is pretty much exactly that, about showing kids that really in each key there's only six chords that really are used for 90% of particularly popular music. So let's teach the kids about that so that they can put it into context when they're playing and listening. Right.
They don't need the two very much, so you can leave that out.
Yep.
So you just go 1, 4, 5 and throw the six in, you're good to go. You don't need the three very much.
Exactly. You've got 90% of pop
four,
music.
1, 4, 5, and 6, you're good to go.
That's right. It's really great to hear. And also that idea of listening and singing bass lines and trying to pick that out, I think is just such a crucial skill. I don't know about you, but I find kids really, they find it very difficult, particularly if they're not brought up with that over a long period of time with simple things first. I tend to be able to hear it, I think, because I've sung in choirs at the bass part. And I kind of naturally hum bass lines. But did you find it difficult for kids to often hear that? And they'll much more easily sing the melody, obviously.
Yeah, I think maybe that's a better place to start, is pick out the highest notes you hear, you know, and then once you've done that, then pick out the lowest notes you hear. And I would always tell them, if a note that you play doesn't sound right, that's a really good sign. Because some people can't tell when they play, you know, they can't tell when they go, you know, they don't sense anything wrong with that, because their ear's not good enough, you know? So you always say, you know, if you're struggling because it sounds wrong, that's a really good sign. That means that you sense when it's wrong. And that's half the battle, is sensing when you got it wrong.
Well, look, let's talk a little bit more about the Piano Guys then. And I'd just love to know how it all came about. I think you mentioned before that the Piano Guys was actually the name of your local piano store. Is that right?
Well, Paul, who I talked about, who had the piano store with all the pianos, was a good friend. When I would perform in St. George, Utah, he would always supply the piano. And then I got to know him that way. And then he would invite me to his store to do events for piano teachers. I would do workshops with note reading and all that stuff, and also songwriting. And so I got to know him really well. And we put out a video that kind of went viral. It was Love Story by Taylor Swift meets Viva La Vida by Coldplay.
Oh, yeah.
And it went viral. And Paul saw that and the wheels got turning. He's like, you know, I would love to do some piano. We put pianos in really cool locations. And he asked me to kind of do a favor for him, you know, and come down and play some of my compositions on these pianos that he would put it like in the canyon or whatever. And we did two or three tunes of my original compositions, and he wanted to put them on this channel, on this YouTube channel called The Piano Guys. That was the name of his store, and to see if he could use that as marketing to do a little better than newspaper and radio. And so it just kind of helped him with that.
Happened.
Yeah. And it did. And in fact, and then it kind of took off a little bit. And then we're like, let's try to pull out all the stops. And we got Stephen Sharp Nelson involved, who I had been collaborating with. And he is an amazing cellist, very innovative. And he also played with me on Love Story meets Viva La Vida, that first one. He was playing cello and kick drum simultaneously.
Oh, wow.
And I think people thought it was really unusual and cool. So he had just gotten a brand new electric cello, and we decided, let's see how many sounds this electric cello can make. Uh-huh. And we just tried, and we came up with 50 invented textures on that electric cello. And we tried to use them all in this song called Michael Meets Mozart. And then we got a fan base that had been built up over the years to share it. And it just went viral again. And
wow.
At that point, it was too late to change the name, because we thought we'd love to do this now. with a pianist and our cellist, Stephen Sharp Nelson, but we don't want him to be known as a piano guy. That's just so horrible.
You know? For a cellist,
but
yeah.
But we found that you can't change a YouTube name without losing your views. And we had racked up like millions of views at that point. And we felt like we just, you know, we just got to go with this name.
So how's Steve coping now?
I know, poor Steve. We tried. He's in therapy, but he's doing okay.
You guys are quite well known for mashing up old and new works when you perform. So I think you've mashed up the Canon in D. You've mucked around with Swedish House Mafia's Don't You Worry, Child. I used to love Swedish House Mafia when they were really popular a few years back. And more recently, film scores like Jurassic Park. So I'm interested to know, what's your process for creating those arrangements and choosing the song you might pull apart?
Yeah. You know what? We all love classical, but we also love any good music, whatever age it's from. And at that point, we survey the landscape, and we're ready to use whatever in whatever combination. It's sort of, in my mind, it's sort of like cooking. And one of our favorite spices, two of our favorite spices are pop and classical. And we're just not afraid to use them together. And they sound really great together. Like, if we're going to arrange a pop tune, we love to put a lot of classical spice in there. And sometimes literally, you know, classical music is full of hooks. Like, right. if you did a highlight reel of classical music, it would be so cool to watch, you know, if there was any way to get it all in one place. So we try to take those little highlights and we'll literally use them and combine them with popular things, and vice versa. If we want to arrange a classical piece, then we'll use some pop spice,
right?
You know, and use both of them simultaneously.
And of course, this is incredibly controversial, John, because there are a lot of people who really worry or feel that classical, you know, shouldn't be mucked around with. And
we've come across that a lot.
Right.
I
was just going to say, I had a listener comment saying, what does John think about mixing classical pieces with other music? Isn't it an act of violation? Doesn't he think that it can change our perception of the original piece forever?
You know, and I saw that comment and I gave it a lot of thought, it's things that I've thought over the years. One thing that comes to mind is, I know that Beethoven would take and cover and do 12 variations on Handel or Mozart, and Brahms would do 12 variations on Schumann or whoever. And so even the greats were covering and trying their spin on things.
Right.
And I think a lot of people have often wondered, well, I wonder if Beethoven and Mozart and Bach had the technology that we have today and were familiar with the innovations that have occurred in music, if they would have, what they would have done with that. And I'll bet they would have incorporated it,
100%.
Is my opinion.
Yep.
And I think, you know, you might say that it's tarnishing the original, but there probably is an element. There's probably pluses and minuses, you know, there probably is that minus, but I think there's more pluses, because I think it also introduces those originals to people that never would have found it, which I think is very valuable. A lot of times on our videos, we'll put a link to say, you know, we've been inspired on this piece by Beethoven, you know, Fifth Symphony. And then we'll put a link to a performance on YouTube. And then if you go to that link and click on it, several of the top comments say, "Piano guys brought me here," you know, and people have discovered a new work of art.
Right.
And I have to say also, just one more thing on that, all of me has been totally covered and changed. Like, one guy, a guy named Jason Black, did a version of All of Me in the minor key and called it None of Me. And it's just so cool. I mean, it's just so cool. And it's so inspirational. It's such a compliment to me when I see that. Another person did a banjo cover, and I've seen drum covers, and I saw somebody do a full-on instrumental redo of it, and it was just so flattering to me. And I'm thinking, if if it could spark somebody's imagination, I am complimented. And I hope that Beethoven and Bach and Mozart might feel the same, that it would be a compliment, you know. And of course, nowadays, everybody just covers one another, you know. Right. That's just something that we do. Mm. So
yeah,
I hopefully could resolve that concern for a lot of the classical purists.
Yeah.
That I know that is disturbing to them, that somebody would put their own spin on Moonlight Sonata.
Mm.
And
what's your, yeah, what's your take on the traditional stuffy, in air quotes, classical recitals? Do you feel, you know, where it's all tails and people aren't sure when they're allowed to clap or not and all that kind of stuff? Do you think there's a life for those still in the future, or is it people like you and some of these more modern composers who might be taking elements of that? You're still playing traditional instruments on a stage, but there's something different about it that will keep that kind of recital going.
I hope that what we do will enhance will increase the interest in the, I just feel like I respect it so much. I respect when somebody comes out and plays Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, you know, flawlessly. And I just feel like there's a spirituality about that music that is, I think it's appropriate that that we treat it with the respect that is treated with. You know, I don't know if it would be appropriate to hoop and holler in the middle of when somebody nails a lick on Emperor's Concerto. It's like, woo!
Yeah.
You know? I think we need to give each other a chance to just really sink into this, because I think the inspiration, and that's the other thing, that I, as a composer, I feel like the inspiration doesn't originate with me. And so therefore, hopefully I would think that I know Bach, for example, felt that way, that the inspiration didn't originate with him. And so if somebody takes that inspiration and, you know, puts their own interpretation on it. But my point is that it's inspiration. And I think those composers were really dialed into it.
Mm. Yep.
And I think it needs to be respected. It's a different sort of, I mean, jazz is inspiration too, but it's just, it's a different flavor. I don't know. There's a more spiritual flavor. There's a more fun flavor. There's a more, I'm rambling a little bit.
I guess my question was probably, it might've been a bit poorly worded. It was more related to whether you feel that there is still going to be, in 10, 20 years' time, audiences for classical recitals and the performers that are needed to create them? Or do we really have to start looking at things like you guys are doing that appeals to a wider audience?
Yeah, it's not fair that what we do appeals to a much wider audience. It's just something we have to acknowledge.
Why isn't it fair?
But I would do everything I could to give the widest possible audience to those that deserve it so much more than we do, from a talent perspective, from a practice perspective. I guess the only thing they don't do is write their own stuff. And that's why we can't practice. It's because we're writing, you know? So that's the trade. But their skill level, it's like Princess Bride, when the guy just devotes his life to sword fighting. And it's just like, I would rather, you know, I wouldn't, what is the line where he's like, I would sooner break this stained glass work of art than kill you. And he just knocks him out. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, it's just like, they're so amazing. They're superhuman. And I never want it to die. I never want the classical genre to die, and the classical stage and the, you know, concerts. It's, I think they would do well to try to pick more of the classical music that is more accessible, and to maybe steer a little bit more away from the stuff that's so esoteric. I think that would be a good call for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But because there's very few people that enjoy that esoteric stuff. It's usually just the elites.
Right. Right. I once made the mistake of going to an all atonal music recital, and I that was a mistake I will not make again.
I don't know if I mind if that part dies. Right. I don't know if I mind. Okay. And I think it might help the life of classical music if it did die. I just let the people that like it like it, and let them get together in their living rooms, because that's about how many people you have. But don't force it upon everybody else for elitism, you know? That's my opinion.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, I'm really keen to talk about your upcoming tour in just a moment, but I did have a couple of quick listener questions. Firstly, someone asked, will you be printing the music to your Jurassic Park arrangement?
I think we didn't get the print rights to publish the sheet music on that. I think we're still working on that.
Okay. So it might be in the future.
Yeah.
I know how long copyright approvals take to get. It's quite a job. someone else asked about your practice. Can you give us a really quick overview? Do you still do scales? Do you play some classical before you practice your own stuff?
I have to do a Hannon regimen at least 3 times a week if I want to be able to play anything fast. I need my fingers to be strong to play. Some of the stuff we do is, you know, pretty fast and challenging. So,
the fingers
need to be in shape. I've kind of developed some Hannons that work all the fingers, you know, the couples and then the weak ones. And then I've got like 4 different exercises that I do in a row that just keep the fingers in shape.
Right.
Keep them strong.
Yep.
The minute they get weak, my playing just goes to pot.
Right.
And I care about my audiences way too much. So I keep them strong.
That's great. And what advice would you give to young music students, particularly teenagers who want to explore their creativity? A similar question from someone else saying, any advice for pianists who are just starting to improvise?
You know, a really cool bit of advice that I heard given from a jazz artist said that every time he heard something cool, like a solo, he would learn it note for note. And I would really recommend that. And I heard a guitarist go one step further on that. He said he would learn it note for note in every key.
Oh, my goodness. So, what?
That guy was a shredder. He was one of the best guitarists in Utah, which is the state where I'm from. He was like a studio guitarist, and he was amazing. And it made me realize that if somebody wants to get good at something, they've got to be obsessed. It's got to be a love. And it's got to be similar to when a kid gets a new video game that they've wanted for a long time and they finally get it. They're going to spend not 10 minutes a day, but hours a day playing that video game, trying to find all of the levels, trying to research it. And music can become that way. And really anything can become that way. You can gain a love for it, which can lead to an obsession. And I'm talking about obsession in a good way.
Mm.
And that always my advice to kids is you've got to get obsessed with it on some level in some way. And that always leads to a lot of time, putting a lot of time in.
Yeah. And that's the challenge for us as teachers is inspiring kids enough that they become obsessed in a good way, as you say. It's one of the hardest things.
You would never impose that sort of time on a student. But as a teacher, I think you hope that you can plant the seed or give the spark that they will do it on their own.
Mm.
But I do believe that until a student gets to that point of obsession because of love, that they won't ever get really satisfied and become really incredible at their art, whether it be piano or dance or sports or whatever it is. I saw my kids do the same thing with basketball, put that sort of obsession into their shooting practice and their whatever, you know. And I think it's when that amount of time, when your daily practice changes from 20 minutes to like several hours, that's when you see progress.
You go bang. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, look, it's been So great to speak with you today, John. And I'm personally so excited about your Australian tour, which people might not know about. So this could be the announcement.
We are so excited. We've been trying to get to Australia. Yeah, we've been trying to get there for so long. And we've got so many wonderful fans down there. We've got, there's ways you can kind of sense it on social media, where people are from and how intensely they enjoy your stuff you're putting out. And we get, it's pinging off the charts in Australia, and it's just been hard to get down there. So we're really excited.
Oh, that's great. Well, so your tour is starting in Brisbane on the 28th of September, and then you're heading over to Perth on Saturday, the 29th of September, Sydney on Monday, the 1st of October, and finishing in Melbourne on Tuesday, the 2nd of October. You're going to have a busy time there. What can fans expect at this concert?
We're going to pull out our very best. It's all of the lollipops.
All the hits we've been talking about?
Very best show. As we look past our past 7 years, we're going to say, what is the very best show that we can put together for that tour? So we're just so excited to get there.
Fantastic. And there'll be obviously solos. There'll be you working with Steve. There'll be a whole mix of things. Will the piano
elements.
Oh, great. Will the piano be opened up and seven of you inside a piano plucking strings?
Yeah. We'll throw that in there too. It's definitely.
Excellent. Definitely. I can still picture
that. It's really a cool variety show. One of the fun things for me to go do is to go on to Ticketmaster and read the reviews. And it's just awesome, and I've compared it with other acts and so forth. You're always going to get your negative reviews. There's not one act that doesn't get that, but we get so few compared to other acts. And the thing that's really fun to watch and to look at is how people describe their experience at the show. And so many people say it was better than the videos and more entertaining. And we came away just like totally surprised. And it's just fun to hear that.
Oh, that's great. So for people interested in booking, need to head to thepianoguys.com/tour. And of course, all the information's on thepianoguys.com. And we should mention too, John, that your books are available on Amazon, I'm pretty sure, your 67 fun songs, which is your introductory method.
Yeah, and also at pianoguys.com might be the more sure way of getting that. And I'm about to put that out into a video form.
Oh, great.
This whole note reading, that just taking the mystery out of those dots and lines and, turning it more into a type approach where I give people 20 minutes a day of stuff and I help them daily, with what's going on. And it's just sort of a note reading for dummies thing that I'm doing. And I think, if piano teachers even wanted to use that to give their students a really great note reading foundation before and have that be like a prelude to what you do as a teacher. But now you're starting a kid and they're really good at reading notes, and then you just go from there and do what you normally do.
So. Right. Well, let me know when it comes out and I'll do my best to spread the word for you.
Thank you.
And last question. If we as teachers in our studios are trying to encourage and inspire more John Schmitz to come through in our students, what would you say the one thing or one or two things we should be doing is?
Yeah, I think classical, as much as possible, as much as some kids will tolerate more than others, and then well-rounded, encourage them to do the things that we've talked about, to try their hand at playing something by ear. And, every time they learn something by ear, you get better. Your ear improves and you get better at it. When I first tried to learn a song, it took me 4 months. And, I got to the point where sometimes I could listen to a song once or twice and just play it.
Mm.
But that took a process of refining the ear. And but those simple things, learn this 30-second spot. It doesn't need to be a whole song. You don't need to feel like you got all the chords and all the notes in between the melody and the bass. Teach them a little bit about, just challenge them and find their fun. Find what is fun for them. I would say that's powerful. I think as I was teaching, if I could find a song that the student brought to me or that the student was interested in, I always felt like that song is going to bump them up a year's time because they're going to put love into that and they're going to put extra time into that. So I think that's a big advantage. And maybe just give yourself permission to not, you know, be so rigid. That's what I would say as a teacher, you know.
Yep. So that's a great summary. And I should have asked too, you're in your studio. Are you recording a new album at the moment? Or preparing for the tour?
We're working on an arrangement of A Million Dreams from the Greatest Showman.
Oh, and I just saw that last weekend. Amazing. Yeah.
And I really was inspired by that song as far as making an arrangement that works. Just if you have a pianist and you don't have a cellist handy, you just want to play this arrangement with just a piano. So I'm really excited. There will be some cello textures as well, but it will be an arrangement that will be, you know, you'll be able to play it totally solo piano. And it's coming together really cool because there was the question of, should I go big with this or should I go mellow with this? And it just felt like the message of the song is a million dreams, you know, and it's just really grandiose and big. And so it's fun.
I'm going to look out for that really one. That's great. We'll look out for it online. John, thank you so much for your time today and wishing you all the best for your upcoming tour. I'll be waving from the audience for sure.
Hey, we got to get you tickets. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Let us know. We'll hook you up.
That would be awesome. Thanks again for your time today.
Thank you.
Well, how cool was that? I have to say I was a little bit starstruck and certainly enjoyed getting to understand just how many synergies there was, in fact, between how John approaches his teaching and how I like to help other teachers with their teaching and how I teach in my studio. So that was really, really, really cool.
How do you keep up to date with all the latest trends and research into music education? How do you connect with other teachers around the world and make sure your teaching stays fresh and relevant for students of all ages and stages, both now and into the future? I created our Top Music Pro membership to be the one-stop shop for music teaching resources, training, support, and community, and I'd love for you to come and join us inside. With over 40 comprehensive training courses, hundreds of teaching demonstrations and lesson plans, free monthly sheet music, discounts, and all the business and pedagogy support you could ever need, Top Music Pro is the community you've been looking for. If you're ready to level up your learning from the podcast and join thousands of other teachers in our global network, head over to topmusicpro.com today. If you enjoy this show and want to hear more of our work, be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening today. For links and resources mentioned in this episode, visit us at topmusic.co/podcast or check out the show notes. I'm Tim Topham, and this is the Integrated Music Teaching Podcast, a production of Top Music. Thank you so much for listening. Enjoy your week ahead, and I'll catch you next time.